Today on Studio 360, one of the great comedic geniuses of our time, I am reading this, Harry Shearer.
Harry Shearer. He'll be talking with me mainly in his normal voice about his role as Mr. Burns on The Simpsons in This Is Spinal Tap and his latest character, Richard Nixon.
I shall resign the presidency, effective at noon tomorrow.
I'll also have a conversation with Christopher Nolan, the director of thinking people's blockbusters. Following up on his Batman movies and Inception, Nolan has engineered a different kind of mind-bending dreamscape and hero's journey in Interstellar.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system?
To our galaxy.
Here we go.
And here we go with another hour of Studio 360.
And don't forget about the so-called Harry Shearer. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides all kinds of streaming entertainment in the sky. Movies, shows, even live TV, all on your personal devices. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. All year long, we've watched as the monstrous Islamic State army has rampaged across Syria and Iraq. There's the grotesque human cost, of course, but they've also got a terrible sideline in wanton material damage, the destruction of ancient landmarks where civilization began. This is from a video they made this summer as one of them took a sledgehammer to the tomb of the biblical and Quranic prophet Jonah in the Iraqi city of Mosul. Secretary of State John Kerry has called for international help in monitoring and stopping the destruction, and with me now is Kerry's Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Richard Stengel. Rick Stengel, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Great to be with you.
So what has ISIL destroyed so far, the major things that we know of over there?
Well, I'll backtrack for one second. ISIL is not only decapitating individuals. They're trying to decapitate civilizations, the civilizations of Iraq and Syria. There is something which is almost as pernicious as the kinetic stuff that they're doing to people, which is the destruction of memory. I mean, they are purposefully going out and destroying monuments and relics and to destroy some of the, what I think is some of the important symbolism of Islamic unity going all the way back to the 7th and 8th centuries. So it's something that they're very proud of. Once upon a time, the bad guys like hid the fact that they were doing this. They are promoting it just the way they're promoting the kind of wanton violence that we're seeing all over the place.
Well, and not only destroying, you know, going after Sufi and Shia shrines and stuff, but going after, for instance, this ancient temple that is revered, Jonah's tomb, by every religion in the area. It really is as though they're trying to do the erasing civilizational memory on the grandest scale or the largest scale or the most horrible scale I've almost ever seen in my lifetime.
Yes, and that, I mean, that this is the cradle of civilization in the sense that, you know, there are the three Abrahamic religions, right? Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. These are monuments for every religion. I mean, those three religions revere some of the same figures, some of the same relics, some of the same people. So it is a destruction of a cultural memory that actually we should be trying to remember at this point.
Right. Have we, the U.S. government, sort of said, okay, here are the other things in this region that they now control? These are the sites that are now most threatened?
The State Department has a publication. It's called a Red List of Syrian Cultural Objects at Risk. And part of what that is to let people know, customs officials, because they do a lot of trafficking in this illegal stuff. I mean, they find middlemen to sell them, and then this becomes part of their financial lifeline.
I've read that experts in Middle Eastern archaeology, some of them are calling for the Security Council of the United Nations to more effectively and stringently ban the trade in antiquities. Is that out of the question?
It's not out of the question, and I don't know that there's a proposal out there, and you mentioned what the Security Council may consider, and I think when and if that comes up, that's something that we would absolutely consider.
As the U.S. military involvement ramps up, presumably that will distract them from the business of destroying cultural monuments, at least?
Certainly, since the airstrikes began from the U.S. and the coalition in Iraq and Syria, yes, they are much more on the run. I think it's interrupted their communications lines, their command and control lines. And so we've seen some diminishment of this. But again, as you know, in the media space and the digital space, it's a horizontal space. I mean, there are people who are obviously out of the line of fire who are working the digital space at the same time. So you can't kind of stamp out everything all at once.
The movie Monument Men came out in the last year about the people who went in at the end of World War II trying to save various cultural treasures in Europe from destruction by the Nazis. Once the combat situation and the security situation is, one hopes, advanced 6 months or a year from now, might it make sense for the United States to sort of essentially get archaeological boots on the ground over there to try to stabilize and tally what's there and what's been destroyed and save what's remaining?
Yes, absolutely. One of the bureaus that reports into me is the Education and Cultural Affairs, but underneath them is the Cultural Heritage Center, which has basically been around since World War II, which is a modern-day monuments men and women who work with the State Department and have, you know, for decades been dealing with cultural destruction, talking to governments about trying to prevent it, you know, even to the point of restoring. You know, part of what they do is restore objects and give them back to the host government. So, yes, we will be doing this after the kinetic part of the battle ends, and we're doing it right now even while it's going on.
Rick Stengel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Richard Stengel is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. The typical Christopher Nolan movie takes place on a very stylish Mobius strip. Time shifts this way and that. Heroes morph into anti-heroes. Nolan's movies can be challenging. You may have to watch them twice just to get them. Like the fantastic told-in-reverse whodunit Memento, or the dream-within-dream heist story Inception. And then there's his Batman movies.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
Nolan's slick, noirish reboots are as close to cinematic art as the superhero movie gets. His latest film is Interstellar, starring Matthew McConaughey, Jessica Chastain, and Anne Hathaway. As our near-future Earth turns into a doomed dust bowl, a handful of space explorers heads off to find a new home.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth.
Christopher Nolan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So movies about space travel come with a big burden of the past. One thinks of 2001, Star Wars, Houston, We Have a Problem. As you were conceiving of this film, did you think, there are certain tropes I have to avoid or embrace, or how did that work?
Well, somebody I was talking to about the film put it very politely in that they said the film is in conversation with 2001. Which I took to be a polite version of ripping it off. But I think the way I had put it is I can't make Interstellar as if 2001 didn't exist. I live in a world where it exists, and it's my chief inspiration for making the film. So I really tried to simply be inspired by it and try, hopefully, and add something.
But no apes or Johann Strauss.
No Strauss, no apes, exactly. But not in front of the camera anyway.
It is different from many of your previous films in being so grounded in human relationships and the peculiar bonds and conflicts within families. Did you begin with it, seeing it that way?
I always saw it that way. The thing that drew me to the project was this combination or contrast between a very intimate story of a father and his children and that relationship and how it's tested, and the cosmic scale of the test of that relationship, in this case, man leaving the Earth to live somewhere else, you know, moving, finding our place in the universe. Seeing that by looking over the shoulder of a relatable protagonist, a family, that seemed really, really fascinating to me.
And were you ready to do that somehow at 40 in a way that didn't interest you at 30?
I think I was. I mean, I think being a father myself was the reason I really gravitated towards the material.
Of four children.
Of four children. And my eldest child is a daughter, and Cooper, Matthew McConaughey's character in Interstellar, the relationship with his daughter is a very important thing in the film. And yeah, I think as I get older and as I make more films, I find that it's the emotional connection with the stories that keeps me obsessively interested in the project.
Interstellar is set in the future. We don't know when exactly, enough so that space travel through a wormhole is possible. But its vision of the future on Earth is very early 21st century. Nothing is very different.
From a design point of view, myself and my designer, Nathan Crowley, we decided early on that we didn't want the appearance of things to be guessed at in terms of how will people's trousers look in the future, how will their hairstyles be, what will a truck look like in the future. We're asking so much of the audience in terms of absorbing a set of ideas, going on a big journey. I wanted everything to be relatable.
You don't, I read, have an email address or a smartphone. You prefer shooting on location when possible rather than in a green screen. You would like to have effects in the camera rather than spend all your time on post-production. Are you ambivalent or even more resistant to the digital revolution?
I don't regret the transition. I deny that it's even taken place. No, I live in
massive
denial.
I believe you're wrong about that.
I live in massive denial. No, I shoot on film because it's technically the best medium. And so I carry on working that way until something better comes along. For me, there's a theme in the film that really is saying, look, we've had all kinds of technological advancements over the last couple of decades that have been very much to do with what's in our pockets, what's in the corner of our living rooms, how we communicate. I think it would be interesting to see that turn outwards again now. And, you know, when I was a kid, people were looking off the planet. They were looking, okay, how can we use technology to explore our place in the universe? I think one of the themes of Interstellar is maybe we should get back to that. Wouldn't that be exciting?
And you had a famous physicist as your technical advisor. Hmm. Did push come to shove sometimes where you said, no, I want to do this? And he said, you're the movie maker. Go ahead. This isn't true, but go ahead.
No, he never did that.
This is Kip Thorne.
Kip Thorne, a wonderful guy to work with. And he tried to offer me the possibilities of real science, which are far more mind-bending than anything you come up with as a screenwriter. The only one that Kip really put his foot down and said, look, you can't do that, is I had wanted to have an element of the story where a spaceship would travel faster than the speed of light. And he just said,
that's the ultimate no-go.
He's like, it took about 2 weeks of arguing about it. It's like, I'll have to take your word for it,
Kip. You were 28 when you made your first feature, which was called Following, which is about a young man who stalks strangers for fun and then meets a guy who shows him how to break into houses. I want to play a clip of that.
Nothing here of any value.
You don't seem that concerned.
I don't do it for the money.
Why do you do it?
For the adrenaline. And because, like you, I'm interested in people. Now, you can tell a lot about people from their stuff.
That is Jeremy Theobald and Alex Haw in Following. The story is not linear, really. Two different timelines are cut together, which is something that we see in your films, many of them anyway, since Memento, Inception, Interstellar even. All of them, in some sense, they explore either the subjectivity of time, the fungibility of its direction, and all those things. Why is that so interesting to you?
I think part of what's going on is I'm the first of a generation who grew up with home video, and you're making films that are going to be watched more than once by definition because you're going to sell them on home video, you're going to show them on cable TV, people are going to watch them in a different way, they're going to have a different relationship to that narrative, and so it's exciting to take advantage of that.
That's interesting, and I'd never thought of the part that home video had in that, and you make films that require at least two viewings to understand.
I mean, I have years to make these films, and you've only got 2.5 hours, 3 hours to watch it in. So I feel a burden to be putting layers in there, to be putting things that could enhance a second or a third viewing, if you're interested. Obviously, the initial experience has to be
paramount.
You know, that first viewing has to be everything. Otherwise, you won't bother to take a closer look.
Memento was when you came on my radar screen, and I saw it. I thought it was an amazing movie. It was a breakthrough for you. It's about a man with no long-term memory who is trying to hunt down his wife's killer.
Are you sure you want this?
Have I told you what this man did?
Yeah.
Well, then you shouldn't have to ask.
But even if you get revenge, you're not going to remember it. You're not even going to know that it happened.
My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it? Anyway, maybe I'll take a photograph to remind myself.
That was Guy Pearce and Carrie Ann Moss in Memento, which I discovered started out as a short story by your brother, Jonathan Nolan. How did it become a movie?
We were taking a road trip together. We were driving from Chicago to Los Angeles when I first moved to Los Angeles in the late 90s, having just finished Following. And Jonah told me that he was working on a story, and he just sort of told it to me verbally. And I got very excited about it. Immediately sort of said to him, do you mind if I take that, what you've given me, just explaining it to me and write a screenplay from it while you finish a short story?
So you're like one of these predatory producers getting to novels before they're even published.
Well, completely. I had special access because it was my brother, and he, you know, I did warn him at the time. It's like, you know, until you finish with something, keep it close.
Memento is not the only one of your films that is so complicated that it is challenging. Yes, people can watch it again and again on video to get a clearer sense of it. But at the time, were you surprised, given how challenging it is, that this was a commercial success?
Not really. I mean, it was more a question of when you're starting out, you don't know what to be afraid of, and that gives you great courage. But originally, when I set out to do it, I saw it as a very accessible film.
Really?
What I found with my films is people who just sort of sit back and relax and try to enjoy them as a ride, they understand them much better than people who go in sort of, you know, approaching them like there's some kind of crossword puzzle to be solved.
But they sort of invite the crossword puzzle approach, don't they?
I don't know. I encourage people to try and enjoy them as an entertainment first and foremost.
When you pitched the rebooting Batman to Warner Brothers in 2003, you had made three successful movies. You'd shown that you could handle a big budget, but you were not. Oh, Christopher Nolan. Yes, of course. Batman. You got that gig after pitching them for 90 minutes? I've never heard of a 90-minute pitch. What did you tell them?
I don't know, but it must have been good because they signed up. No, I what I told them was, look, they took a hell of a leap of faith. But I think that what they felt from me was a very sincere desire to say, okay, I grew up watching, you know, Dick Donner's Superman, the epic treatment for a superhero. So he's an extraordinary figure in an ordinary world. And what happened with Batman is that film never got made. What got made was Tim Burton's incredible and wonderful and idiosyncratic, you know, could only be Tim Burton, yes, take on the character that was so influential and extraordinary, but sort of sidestepped that kind of more conventional, epic, sort of, okay, let's take an ordinary world and let's put this extraordinary figure in it. And suddenly I found myself going, oh, I know what I would do with it because I know the version of it that I never got to see.
Right. When I saw Batman Begins in 2005, I thought, as I said on this program, it was the best superhero movie I'd ever seen. And then 3 years later, the sequel, The Dark Knight, became the best superhero movie I'd ever seen, and I guess probably still is. I want to play a clip from that. This is where Batman, for the first time, is face-to-face with his nemesis, the Joker.
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, no, no. No, you complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be.
That was Christian Bale as Batman and Heath Ledger as the Joker. Heath Ledger had just won an Oscar for Brokeback Mountain, which didn't make him an obvious choice to play the great villain of our time. Why did you cast him?
I cast him because I'd met him a couple of times over the years for different parts and nothing had really panned out. I admired his work as an actor tremendously, but it really was this thing of just sitting down and seeing in somebody's eyes that they were ready to really show the world something. And when you look at an actor's eyes like that, and you see that they're ready and that they're going to bring something to it that's very, very special, you don't worry about, you know, what people are going to think, what they've done before, what they haven't done before. Uh-huh. You just know it. You see it and you go with that.
And he won the Academy Award posthumously for the role. Did you and he sort of figure out the particular mannerisms together, the phlegmy kind of speech and things? Or how did that happen?
Well, there were some things we talked about. We tried to use the hair and makeup wardrobe tests as a bit of a test bed. You know, we'd get a handheld camera and my DP, Wally Fisher.
And he'd do some lines,
He'd do some lines, but we weren't recording sound.
Uh-huh.
So he was very free. You know, I think that freed him up, that we weren't saying, okay, how does the Joker laugh? Okay, tell us what he does. He was just gradually showing me things that I felt that he'd been working on for many months, truthfully. Oh. And on the makeup front, we collaborated with his makeup artist. I brought in paintings of Francis Bacon and sort of said,
that's
something
interesting.
In these colors. Yeah, there's a feeling of that. Yeah. And one of the things Heath wanted to do first, which is incredibly logical, of course, it completely escaped me, is to try applying the makeup himself. Because obviously, the character would actually have to do that. And, and one of the wonderful things that came out of that was he always had sort of crusty sort of makeup on his fingers and, under his nails and things, which it was just a lovely touch.
That's interesting because people talk about, oh, we never have enough time to rehearse movies. This is a different kind of pre-rehearsal, conceptual rehearsal that you did, it sounds like.
I've found that every actor wants a different thing out of rehearsal. And I think a lot of them, and Heath was certainly like this, they like to sneak up on it. They don't want to be put on the spot and have a bunch of, producers and myself and executives sitting there going, okay, what is it? give us what it is.
Yeah.
And so you'll read a scene, just him and Christian. You'll just talk about it, whatever. And then you'll hear a little bit of a voice coming through, a little bit of a laugh, he's been working on. Watching it develop was a really exciting thing.
Even though you don't want me to look at your movies as crossword puzzles that I'm trying to figure out, I have noticed that in every one, I believe every one, the male lead's wife or girlfriend either is already dead or gonna die. Why is that?
No spoilers, please. Why is that? It's because I work in melodrama. I love film noir. I love crime novels. I love the universality that you are granted by stepping a little further away from conventional drama. And so things like the quest for revenge, or the haunted nature of a protagonist, these are the staples of those forms of melodrama.
But you also you have a clear, rigorous sense of, I don't want to go over this line of reality to cartooniness.
Yeah. When I talk about melodrama, when I talk about heightened reality, I'm really talking about the narrative, the story elements. Uh-huh. As far as tone goes, I think as a filmmaker, I get the most out of trying to adopt as rigorously realistic a tone as possible. And however much you try that, you're still dealing in a theatrical medium. And so the films of today in 20 years' time, they will look heightened, the artifice will be more apparent.
This will be a Baroque period?
Yeah, well, this is true of my work as anybody else's.
Yeah.
But the attempt is to really try and give a feeling of texture, a feeling of reality, because my feeling is the combination of heightened dramatic elements, really extreme story elements, with a believable texture, that for me provides the most exciting entertainment.
Christopher Nolan, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Nolan's latest movie, Interstellar, has just opened in theaters all over America. We actually talked for the better part of an hour, and if you'd like to hear our whole conversation, you may do so at studio360.org. Coming up, the great country singer Hank Williams wrote songs about cheating hearts, crying in your beer, and STDs?
Syphilis. It may hide in your system for many a year and then strike at you and the one you hold dear.
That's later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose long-haul fleet has flatbed seats available with direct aisle access. Learn more at delta.com. Delta. Keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, the cartoonist and new MacArthur genius, Alison Bechdel, challenged you to a dare. Finish the drawing that she started in any style and with any materials, and then send it to us. We're calling it the Great Doodle Dare, and today we hear from a couple of listeners who've already entered.
Okay, my name is John Haug. I live in Roland Park, Kansas. I made her trying to get out of a swimming pool. And then in the bottom of the swimming pool, I put a skateboard. That was to show that she shouldn't be skateboarding in an off-season swimming pool because sometimes it's hard to get out.
My name is Amy, and I live in Austin, Texas. I have a silly sense of humor, so I was inspired by my cat, Luna, who's a very sweet little kitty, but she has kind of an unrequited love for our other cat, Jarvis. And she gets frustrated with him because he's not very nice to her. So she gives him these kind of death stares sometimes. And I thought it would be funny to incorporate that, incorporate the doodle girl into a doodle with my cat, giving him those death stares.
That's the way the dip-to-doodle works.
Amy listens to our show on KUT Austin, and John listens on KCUR Kansas City. You can check out their drawings, along with all the rest of the submissions so far, at studio360.org. And that's also where you can find Alison Bechdel's incomplete cartoon and try your hand at finishing it. But hurry, because the Great Doodle Dare deadline is Monday, November 10th at midnight. Allison will be back on the show to announce our winner.
That's the way the dip-to-doodle works.
Ebola, Ebola, Ita. Don't touch a friend.
For months, radio stations in West Africa have been playing songs that encourage people to take precautionary measures against Ebola. It isn't the first time that pop music has been drafted to get out a critical message about public health. 60 years ago, the United States government enlisted big stars to fight a disease that had cast a pall over life for centuries. Andrew Parsons has our story.
The 1940s were a boom time for public health. Mass-produced penicillin was new, it had been given to U.S. troops during World War II, and it seemed like it could cure anything. Nancy Gooley is retired from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. She says syphilis seemed like a no-brainer for the feds.
And it seemed to have all the tools it needed. It knew what the problem was, it had the medication, it had the ability to get people to get free treatment. But it was dealing with a hush-hush subject, a taboo subject. Syphilis itself, it was as though people felt that they'd be infected by the word.
So the Public Health Service launched what it called the VD Radio Project. They recruited a Columbia University professor and former radio man named Eric Barno to get the message on the air. He produced some pilots, but they weren't being played in the South, where syphilis rates were the highest. Here's Barno in a 1970s oral history.
So I remember talking to Alan Lomax and saying, what do we do about this? And Alan Lomax said, well, what you need as your spokesman is some of the singers from Nashville, like Roy Acuff and Woody Guthrie, etc. So he wrote some things in which the narration was sung in a ballad style by one or another of these hillbilly singers.
So Alan Lomax helped line up some of these so-called hillbilly singers.
So if you ever wonder, just listen to this. Some things don't stay secret in one syphilis. It may hide in your system for many a year and then strike at you and the one you hold dear.
Hank Williams' program was a 14-minute musical drama called Stars in Her Eyes. Here he is narrating the courtship of a young couple, Lena and Joe.
They went out to dinner that Monday night. She felt so nervous, didn't touch a bite. They went out to dinner that Monday night, and he asked for a date for Tuesday.
Sure, Joe.
They went to
just a sweet little love story, right? But after they're married, Joe is out of town one time, and his friend comes over, plies Lena with wine, and then you know what.
Maybe. Fine. We'll have ourselves a sort of celebration to our friendship. Here's to Joe.
To Joe.
After that, well, after that, he forgot his place and she forgot hers.
Oh, Leo.
Next day, she woke up mighty sorry.
Nobody mentions syphilis until you're 10 minutes in. Barna's strategy, in a word, bury the lead.
He seduced his audience, got them to identify with a character, and then he let them know, ooh, this person got syphilis.
Finally, Lena sees the doctor.
You want me to bring in my husband to tell him that
Whatever you tell him, he should have a checkup.
I couldn't.
Now, the chances are he too is infected. He may later on go insane, or blind, or become paralyzed. Black and cheerless was the life that lay ahead. The future filled her heart with dread. She cried all day and cried all night.
Alan Lomax knew he'd have to vary the strategy for African-American communities, which historically had been leery of white doctors telling them what to do.
Well, he went into the home of a gospel singer by the name of Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Probably the biggest gospel star of her time.
And he said, look, this is the problem we have. Would you like to do something about this? Well, she whipped out her guitar. She sat there and started strumming notes on the guitar and spontaneously wrote lyrics for songs on the subject of syphilis.
Doctors in their laboratories have found the cure for the bad disease. And if you're poor, you can have it free. That's the news. That's the news.
In her program, Sister Rosetta Tharpe sang hymns and told stories, like the one about Miss Jones, who had made just one mistake.
But that one mistake brought her a lot of grief. And don't you know it broke that poor woman's heart to learn from doctors that she had given syphilis to her children before they were born? You ought to go and get the water. Why don't you hear the word and obey? You ought to go and get the water. For Jesus is a gift in a way. I want everybody to be quiet while I the story tell. To see the sign it wonders while being at the healing well.
The idea of redemption echoes across these programs. Miss Jones makes a mistake, but it's not too late. And in William's program, Lena doesn't lose her husband.
Joe walked out, but he didn't stay out. He loved her too much.
Joe, it's you.
Yeah, it's me.
Oh, darling, forgive me. Please forgive me.
Let's not talk about it. Not now. Not ever.
So that was the story of Joe and his wife. She told him the truth and she spared his life. But how she
These programs spread across stations like, well, you know. Public health expert Nancy Gooley says they worked.
After you've studied all of the contributing factors, I don't think there is any doubt that this radio campaign, this project, was instrumental in saving thousands of lives.
After the programs aired, they faded from memory. I couldn't find a recording of Roy Acuff's program in any archive. And in Hank Williams' own family, it was forgotten.
My official name is Shelton Hank Williams III, but in the music industry, Hank III.
Hank Williams' grandson, Hank III, had never heard of the VD radio project till I played it for him.
Do you have, does it say that he wrote that, or is it a cover? It has a childhood kind of theme to it, but the words are definitely a lot more in your face and cutting you to the bone.
If you had an opportunity, you know, to do this, do you think that would be a lot harder now in our media environment where it almost seems like the problem is too much information?
It's hard to say because a lot of people, you know, they're not believing as much what they hear. Back then, it seemed like they took it to heart because it meant a lot more. And nowadays, you've been seeing getting a flu shot shoved down your throat everywhere you turn for the last 10 years. And it's hard to say if it's more of a money-making scam compared to, okay, this is a very serious illness that we need to contend with.
Hank's raising a pretty serious issue here. People don't always believe what health officials want them to believe. Fears about vaccination have led to measles outbreaks in Texas and California. But I don't think a country song is going to do the trick. If it were up to me, I'd produce a web series starring Justin Timberlake. For Studio 360, I'm Andrew Parsons.
Andrew Parsons works for the public radio show Backstory, and you can hear the full versions of all those old songs about syphilis at studio360.org.
Homosexuality, dope, immorality generally, these are the enemies of strong societies.
Coming up, I'll talk with Harry Shearer about his obsession with Richard Nixon.
In our lifetimes, I think there hasn't been a person this odd and uncomfortable with himself and with others in any of American politics.
That's still ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360.
Hello, Cleveland!
I'm Kurt Anderson. When modern comedy has been smart and great and influential, Harry Shearer has been there. Stonehenge, where the
demons dwell. Yeah, this is the first album in which we let ourselves be all the Spinal Tap we could be. Stonehenge.
He was one of the creators of This Is Spinal Tap. He was on Saturday Night Live in its early years. He worked with me at Spy Magazine, and for the last quarter century, he has been on The Simpsons, where he's done the voices for Mr. Burns and at least a half a dozen other characters.
Excellent.
Oakley Doakley.
Over here, Simpson.
And now, in his latest role, he plays a character too odd and implausible for fiction, the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. Shearer has transformed Nixon's infamous Oval Office tapes, the Watergate bits of which forced him out of office, into a six-part miniseries called Nixon's The One. All the dialogue in the series comes verbatim from those tapes, and it's filmed to look like it was caught on hidden cameras around the Oval Office.
I was telling Bob the other day, I was trying to tune into this baseball game on CBS. Well, the game went off, and CBS came on with this movie. One they had done themselves, and it's the damnedest thing I ever heard. These two magnificent, handsome guys, this stupid old fella, and a nice girl, and they're glorifying homosexuality. I mean, the two guys are admitting they're homosexuals, so forth. Well, I turned the damn thing off. I couldn't listen anymore.
That is Harry Shearer as Richard Nixon talking about the moral errors of the TV show All in the Family. Harry Shearer, it's my great pleasure to welcome you at last to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. It's my pleasure as well.
You started in comedy, by my reckoning, pretty much right when Nixon became president. At that time, as a young man in America with Nixon as president, did you find him compelling and funny?
Plentifully risible, yeah. I mean, I was in a satire show every day on the radio, and Nixon was the president, and he was doing and saying a lot of things that we found outrageous, infuriating, and therefore comical.
And was your take, I mean, it's hard to know exactly 45 years ago what one thought, maybe, but did you think, oh, he's evil, as many, many people did at the time, or just like, wow, what a freak?
I think somewhere between the two,
yeah,
depending on the day. I mean, I was a draft-age person at some point in that era, and Nixon was a guy who had promised that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War, and the secret plan was, let's stretch it out until my reelection campaign is over. There was a lot of anger in the air,
yeah.
You know, and Nixon responded to it with anger, and it became a really interesting and somewhat vicious cycle.
Yeah. I was thinking about it, and I think about Nixon a lot.
Have you sought medical attention for this?
Has there been a more odd and uncomfortable person in the White House ever, or certainly in our lifetimes?
In our lifetimes, I think there hasn't been a person this odd and uncomfortable with himself and with others in any of American politics. I think he would have flunked the basic test of skill set for politics. He wasn't a person who liked to be
with strangers.
Yeah.
He did not like small talk. He wasn't given to small talk. He didn't have an engaging smile.
No, and his inability to do small talk are my favorite bits. The way you perform them in this show, they're excruciating and wonderful to
Thank
me.
Thank you.
There are thousands of hours of Nixon tapes, only hundreds of which have been transcribed. You don't reenact the important ones,
no.
the Watergate ones. How did you choose which ones to do and for how long and all that?
Well, my goal in setting out to do this show was to do an entertainment show, not a politics show, not a history show. There are plenty of people who have done that. So Stanley Cutler, who's distinguished historian of the tapes, is the guy who actually filed the lawsuit to make the tapes public in the first place when Nixon was fighting viciously and very hard to keep them private.
After he was out of office.
After he was out of office. I said to Stanley, let's do these conversations, you've them historically, I've encountered them recreationally, that are not about Watergate or Vietnam or about politics or history, but about the personality of the guy, this odd character that we both know so well. And to me, that's dark comedy at its best.
One of the things that's so wonderful about this show is how realistically they're acted. Did you direct it? Did you have a director? How did you get there?
Well, I had a director, a wonderful TV director in England named Sasha Ransom, who directed the camera shots and a lot of the performances. But I said, we're doing this real. We're not doing a joke version of this. We're not doing a caricature. And we listened to the tapes. Each scene as we rehearsed, we would listen to the tape over and over again. So all the actors got into the thing of not just the lines, but the pauses and the ways people talk over each other and the backtracks and all the little details of the way these conversations play out and the weird rhythms of them. They're not like conversations I have or you have, I think, with other people.
Just call the attorney general. He can go stick his nose into this thing. Just tell him about the IRS went after Billy Graham and say, now, goddammit, are we going after some of these Democrats? I mean, they have gone after all of our friends. They've gone after John Wayne. They're going after every one of our people. They were after me. For example, somebody told me that Ed Muskie was in Frank Sinatra's plane in California. Did you hear that?
So?
All right. Maybe we can investigate that?
Yeah. It also landed at the wrong airport.
That was Dimitri Gouritsas as White House Chief of Staff Bob Haldeman and Harry Shearer as the president in Nixon's The One. Did playing Nixon and spending so much time in his head change the way you thought of him?
It did a little bit. I mean, you can't spend that much time with a character like Nixon, especially if you're an actor, and not get some more insight than you have just being on the outside, you know, laughing at him. But also, I had to realize during the course of this that as repellent as I found a lot of his foreign policy, his domestic policy was startlingly to the left of the current president.
Well, that's the amazing thing, to see this in 2014. And again, because I am a Nixon buff, he is, people have said, and it's true, maybe the most left president of our lifetime.
Yeah.
And you may not have liked his Vietnam policy, but he did reapproachment with China, started detente with the Soviet Union.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he was a raving, not just a rhino, he was a some other animal that isn't a Republican.
That's also extinct. Yeah, but he was in the very center of the Republican Party
yes.
of that era. Rockefeller was to his left.
Yes.
Goldwater was to his right. Yeah. He'd get primaried out in a split second out of today's Republican Party.
This is not the first time you've played a president of the United States.
No.
Back in 1990 in an episode of The Golden Girls, which I missed and was happy to come to again for this, you did the voice of George H.W. Bush.
Hello, Mr. President. Can I ask you something?
Well, sure.
Is the Oval Office as hard to vacuum as I think it is?
I don't know. There hasn't been a Hoover in the White House in 60 years.
That was a good one, sir.
Wow.
Yes.
I don't remember doing that.
Yeah. Uncomfortable presidents.
Yeah.
Making jokes that people have to force themselves to laugh at. It's especially. Have you always been good at vocal impersonation?
I guess. I mean, I remember putting myself to sleep as a child doing the voices of people on my favorite programs, and I figured out much later what I was doing, which was I was training my ear.
I have always been staggered by the fact that I learned from you many years ago that at age 13 you were in the pilot of Leave It to Beaver doing the Eddie Haskell role. But I didn't know until doing the research for this conversation that your parents stopped you from taking that part?
Well, they said, you know, if I was a working actor, but I was going to public school, And they said, if you're on a show every week, we're going to have to take you out of public school. You're going to have to go to that special school for actors. And they just said, we want you to have a normal childhood. So
and you agreed to that?
Yeah, I was fine.
Yeah. As a kid, did you figure, though, that this is what I'm going to do when I grow up?
No. I thought this was going to be fun. And then I'd have, you know, I was plotting to be either in government or journalism or teach school.
And now you're in all those things except government.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Thank God. I run into people all the time who say Spinal Tap taught me how to be in a band. So I've made an educational film.
Spinal Tap, which you did when you were 40, was, I mean, you'd been working, you'd been successful, but that was a huge breakthrough in terms of your...
My profile, as I said.
But also, it's this enduring success that you can die happily having been a part of.
Yeah.
I want to play a bit of it.
We're very lucky in the sense that we've got two visionaries in the band. You know, David and Nigel are both like poets, you know, like Shelley or Byron, people like that. The two totally distinct types of visionaries. It's like fire and ice, basically. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, I feel my role is in the band is to be kind of in the middle of that, kind of like lukewarm water, in a sense.
That's you as the bassist, Derek Smalls, along with Christopher Guest and Michael McKean.
And Rob Reiner, the interviewer.
And Rob Reiner, the interviewer and director.
Yeah.
Did it feel, as you were doing it, like, whoa, we're really inventing a genre and changing comedy history?
No, it felt like we were having fun.
Yeah.
We knew that the audience knew the story and that if we could make a film that was true to the story, we'd get some response.
They
from
knew
an audience
the story
of a rock and roll band. Everybody knew how rock and roll bands worked by that time.
Yeah.
You know, Rolling Stone and everything had, everybody knew it. So we figured it would resonate with some part of the audience. We had no idea, you know, that it would be resonating.
You'd still be doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And teenagers would be coming up and saying, I just saw that movie. Oh, my God.
You did a stint before your profile had gotten so high with Spinal Tap on Saturday Night Live in 1979. Hated it.
Mm-hmm.
Went back in 1984. Hated it again. Why'd you hate it?
You ever had a really bad boss?
I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, get a job at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I thought it was like Jonestown. It was like a mind control experiment, partly because the schedule there is different every day in such a way that by the end of the week, your body clock has been screwed with in a really subversive way. And partly because I was, I think, at odds aesthetically with the show. I like to work small, and that had been a stage that had been the place where people worked big, comedically speaking. You know, that's not me. So I was always trying to kind of tone it down a little bit, and I was always trying to be realer than I thought the show wanted. You know, a show that had a guy playing Nixon with a mustache really didn't care that much about how people look like the character. I care a lot.
You have, as I said, for the last quarter century, been the voice of a bunch of characters on The Simpsons, Mr. Burns, Smithers, Ned Flanders, Principal Skinner, and more. Do you love them all equally as your children, or do you have a favorite?
C. Montgomery Burns.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the evil, for the purity of his evil. You know, a lot of people try to dilute the evil, and that's a mistake. Go with it.
And there are those who think Nixon is pure evil.
Yeah, I know. In real life, I mean, we're talking about a cartoon character with Burns. In real life.
And we're talking about a different kind of cartoon character with Richard
Nixon. Yeah. I think, in a way, that's a cop out. It's a cliche to say there's good and evil in all of us.
Yes.
But it's the cliche because it's true.
Yep.
And because you never know when the good people turn evil on you. And as we were saying, you know, when you look back at Nixon, he did a lot of things that you'd want to sort of hornswoggle this president into doing if you could possibly find the wild horses to do it. You know,
and so there will never be that Mr. Burns revisionism in the future. You look back on Burns and
– No. That's what I say. That's why I admire him as a comic character.
You also, in your vast portfolio of professional activities, have since 1983 been doing Le Show on many public radio stations.
Yeah.
So you've got the Simpsons job, which has made you rich beyond reckoning. You're a filmmaker. You're a stage actor. Why do you do this labor-intensive thing every week for the radio?
Because I like to keep myself writing and coming up with new characters, and I like to maintain contact with the audience, but I don't like entertaining drunks, so I won't do stand-up.
You don't care if people are drunk at home?
They can be drunk at home. I just don't have to hear them. I encourage them to be drunk at home, as a matter of fact. But it's a way to have direct contact with a putatively mass audience without having any mediation. There are no meetings. There's never been a meeting before a show. There's never been a memo after a show. It's pure direct communication.
That makes sense. Harry Shearer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
You can listen to Harry Shearer's Le Show online or perhaps on your local public radio station. And Nixon's The One is available on YouTube at My Damn Channel. Let's get down. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you for joining us. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Penamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music's by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.